Worried about letting someone else pick out the perfect avocado for your perfect impress them on the third date guacamole? Well, good thing Instacart shoppers are as picky as you are. They find ripe avocados like it's their guac on the line. They are milk expiration date detectives. They bag eggs like the 12 precious pieces of cargo they are. So let Instacart shoppers overthink your groceries so that you can overthink what you'll wear on that third date. Download the Instacart app to get free delivery on your first three orders while supplies last. Minimum $10 per order. Additional terms apply.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you love true crime or comedy, celebrity interviews or news, you call the shots on what's in your podcast queue. And guess what? Now you can call them on your auto insurance too with the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. It works just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance, and they'll show you coverage options that fit your budget. Get your quote today at Progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.
Play ball! It's 30 with Murdy with your host, Sweeney Murdy.
Hi, everyone. Welcome back on this episode, a conversation with Randy Wilkins, the director of The Captain. That's the 7-part film about Derek Jeter, a look at Derek's life and career, just like The Last Dance about Michael Jordan 2 years ago. The Captain features plenty of interviews with Jeter, his friends, teammates, family, and other people who were there along the way, including the media that covered him. Yeah, I do appear in this film a few times along the way. I've also watched some previews of the first few episodes. I think Yankee fans for sure will enjoy it a great deal, and others will appreciate the peek into Jeter's life. The first episode airs Monday, this coming Monday, July 18th on ESPN, 10 p.m., right after the All-Star Home Run Derby, with the remaining episodes scheduled to run every Thursday from July 21st to August 11th. They're also going to be available to stream on ESPN+. Randy Wilkins is a filmmaker who was born and raised a Yankees fan from the Bronx. His 2-decade working relationship with Spike Lee brought him into this project, which is over a year in the making. In this conversation with Randy, we talk about the roots of this film, the process of making it, and the different parts of Derek Jeter's life and career that come into brighter focus along the way here. Here's my conversation with the director of The Captain, Randy Wilkins. Randy, I guess one of the first things that they tell you is don't ever meet your heroes. I know you're a Yankee fan and how much you admired Derek Jeter during his career. So as you got to meet him and know him during this process, how do you feel about that statement? Don't meet your heroes.
I think this is one of the rare instances where it was cool to meet your hero. It was worth meeting your hero. And I think everything that you hear about Derek is true. All the positive things. There's some things I learned about him, but yeah, it's absolutely a situation where it was cool to meet your hero for once.
All right. I'm going to get into the making of this and some of the details of it in a minute, but I guess the story is that Derek went to Spike Lee about this and Spike couldn't do it. And he recommended you. How did you end up first getting connected with Spike? I know you've worked on some of his other projects. How did that relationship build for you?
So my relationship with Spike is longstanding. I've pretty much known him my entire adult life. I've known him close to 20 years. I was working as a filmmaker in residence at my undergrad, Franklin & Marshall in Lancaster, Pennsylvania. And Spike came as a guest of the school. So he was there for a day or two. It was split up over a couple months. And I ended up being Spike's host since I was like the filmmaker guy on campus at that point. I had graduated, but I was working there.
Okay.
And Spike, I gave Spike a documentary I'd made before he got there. And, you know, I asked him next steps. I mean, I had access to him. So, and I was trying to figure out if I wanted to actually pursue filmmaking. At that point, I had just gotten into it by accident. And he said I needed to learn how to make narrative films. And I was so green that I didn't know what a narrative film was. I didn't even understand that term. And he said, well, if you want a recommendation to NYU graduate film, I'll give you one. And I obviously took him up on that. I eventually got into NYU. I was waitlisted, actually. So it took me a while to get in. And then, Spike basically took me under his wing. My first job with him officially was as an editorial PA on Inside Man back in 2004. And then I rose through the ranks and became one of his editors and like trusted collaborators. So Spike and I Again, I've had a longstanding relationship. He means a great deal to me. He's had a tremendous impact on my life. And yeah, he basically put me in a position to tell Derek's story. Derek and Spike are also longtime friends. And I think from what I've been told, that if Derek had ever decided to do something like this, he wanted Spike to do it. Obviously, the longstanding relationship, and Spike is a legend. And yeah, Spike said that he wasn't able to do it because he had prior commitments, but he said he had the perfect guy to tell the story, and I just happened to be that guy. So I'm very appreciative of Spike and Derek.
If he, next time you talk to Spike, can you tell him he still owes me a piece of gum? I don't know if I told you, 1996, I'm pretty sure it was game one of the World Series. I was working as a producer at FAN, and I was on the field watching batting practice, and we're set up behind the batting cage, all the actions on the cage. I think we're on the warning track at Old Yankee Stadium behind the batting cage. And I find myself, there's almost so much media and different people around. And all of a sudden I looked over and Spike Lee is just standing right next to me. And I'm going, oh my gosh. Right. And like, I'm trying to figure out what to say to him. Like, he doesn't know me. He isn't, you know, no reason to know me. And I'm looking at him. And I just go, that's pretty cool, huh? And he looks at me. He goes, you have another piece of gum? I guess I was chewing gum. So I reached in my pocket, I gave him a piece of gum. I was like, all right, cool. And like, that was it. Like, I mean, you know, I'm pretty sure he could have afforded his own gum, but he had to take one off of me. So please tell him next time you talk to him, he owes me a piece of gum with 26 years of interest. That's whatever that.
Got you. To, all right? I got you.
Listen, Derek Jeter is very popular and a very charismatic figure. I think we all know that. But he was also not very colorful in the media. I think people around him know what kind of character he was and could be. But for somebody who didn't want to portray that publicly during his very private life, why would you as a filmmaker find him an appealing project?
Because I think the challenge is trying to reveal that character to the rest of the world. You know, it is there. I mean, Sweeney, you know,
yeah,
what's behind all of it. And I think the challenge and the thing that makes this so compelling is to bring that out of him and to show the rest of the world that this actually exists, that the perception and persona that he had publicly for those 20 years as a Yankee isn't a true reflection of who he is as a human being and as a man. So, I know that there was a lot under the surface. I know that Derek was ready to reveal a lot of that to the world. So as a filmmaker, you know, you want to be challenged. You want to find a story that other people can't tell or tell it in a way that others haven't. So with Derek, it was very clear, you know, to present this part of his humanity and his personality and share it with the rest of the world.
All right. So in your conversations with him leading up to really just starting this and getting going, what were those conversations like? What did you want to get across to him? What did he want to get across to you? How much of it was you want to say, listen, this is my movie. You know, like I need to have certain, you know, authorities on certain things. Like how did that relationship work as you had the conversations with him leading up to it?
I think he knew that in order for this to work, he was going to have to talk about certain topics. So I think he probably had conversations with his wife, Hannah. I'm sure he had conversations with his agent, Casey Close. I think that this was something that was brewing with him for a while before I got there. Mm-hmm. There wasn't a lot of convincing that I had to do because it felt like he understood what the importance of this was and what the foundational pieces needed to be in order for this to work. We had like blunt conversations, but they were good conversations. There was never any tension. There was never any conflict. We were always in alignment. You know, I tell people that the first time I spoke with Derek, it felt like I knew him for 10 years already. So we were always in alignment. And I know that there were some things that, you know, at first I think he was reticent to like speak totally freely about, but by the time that we were done, I think he and I were both surprised at how much he had actually talked about them. So, yeah, I mean, they were just like honest conversations, but they were collaborative, creative conversations. I think it helps that Derek is also a storyteller. You know, he has the Players Tribune. He has his publishing company. I think stories are important to Derek beyond the film. You know, this isn't something that's foreign to him. So I think he intrinsically understands what makes a good story. So I think that also helps. So, yeah, there were great conversations. There was never at any point where we had a conflict or like we saw things differently. We were always in lockstep. I was always respectful of the fact that, you know, he is private and he does believe in protecting his loved ones. So going into it, I was very aware of that. And I didn't want to violate that. You know, I think that that's important. You know, you don't want to go to a point where you lose Derek and then he kind of shuts down. And I think that's true for anyone. It would be true if I did a film on you. I think that there's certain things that you have to respect for the subject to make sure that they're comfortable and you earn their trust and keep their trust. So, yeah, it was a great process. I learned a lot. And I'm very thankful that, you know, Derek was as open as he was in the film.
The 9-part series on my life is coming out next summer, I believe.
Yeah.
As you got to him on things that were, let's just call it controversial, for lack of a better term, okay? Did you find it that there was some convincing to get him to open up more, or did you feel like he knew this was his opportunity to tell his side of that story and he wanted to do it?
Yeah, and I mentioned that to him. You know, I said, this is probably one of the rare opportunities where you can influence the narrative instead of other people influencing the narrative. Like, and I don't mean that to say that like he was controlling of the situation. Again, it was a collaboration, but I mean, it's his story. You know, he can kind of take control of it in a way where there isn't a middleman or middlewoman. Like what he says is on record, you know, and it can come from him. So, yeah, I mean, I think he understood that, he embraced it, and it was more like, okay, yeah, I'm going to tell my side of the story, and then, you know, whatever the reception or reaction is, so be it. But you know, it was an opportunity to kind of use his platform to his advantage.
Here's a guy who, you know, he didn't lack for publicity during the course of his career, right? So when did you feel like you had broken new ground? Like you had found something that, okay, I'm going to be able to do something here that just hasn't been part of the story before.
Honestly, the first interview, it was even the way that he sat in a chair.
Really?
You know, it was like little things like that where you could tell that he was comfortable. And I think that, you know, he knew that he was in an environment where he wasn't being judged or someone was trying to exploit him or take advantage of him. I think that naturally, Derek's inclination is to ask someone he doesn't really know or know well, what do you want from me? Like, what are you trying to get out of this?
He even says that at one point in the show.
Yeah, exactly. And I think in this situation, he knew that that wasn't happening. He knew why we were there. He knew that it was to have a conversation and that, you know, he can open up as much as he felt comfortable doing so. So I think it was the way he sat in the chair. It was when he cursed on camera.
Yeah, throws you off.
Yeah, oh yeah, totally throws you off. Like every time he like uses profanity, I'm still thrown off by it. And I think that there were certain details to things that people were aware of that he started to share when it was like, and I'm sitting there like, okay, we have something here. You know, like he talks about the contract situation with Cashman and the Yankees and was after the 2010 season. He talks about his relationship with the media, why he did it, but with more like detail and reasoning behind it. So from the first interview, I knew that we had something really good.
All right. So I'm actually just now that you mentioned it, the fact that he does curse and a lot, right? And kind of casually during the course of this.
Yeah.
Why? Like, he knows this is a show. He knows other people are going to see this. So why was this part of it? Like, that's really in direct contrast to the image he has crafted. And he's obviously a family man now. And that's part of his story and his appeal and his image. So why do you think that's part of this show, that he does drop the F-bombs as much as he does?
Because I also think that's part of who he is.
Yeah.
You know, like I think that, you know, he has this public persona and a perception that goes along with it, but there again, there's more to him than just, you know, the very measured public personality of Derek Jeter. There's more to him. He curses. Yeah. You know, he does those things. So I think it's another side that he was comfortable and ready to share with the world. So I think, you know, that he's a very complex guy, and I mean that in a very complimentary way. I think he has a lot of nuance. He's incredibly intelligent. He's very observant. He's aware. You know, he's engaged. And I think that that engagement allows him to open up and shows that he has this very like diverse personality, you know, and has strong feelings about a lot of things. So I think that's why he did it. You know, it's just another side of who he is.
All right. So when you watch the credits in this, you understand right away that it's Excel Entertainment, which is his agency, the Casey Close runs. It's the Players Tribune. His imprint is on this. So how much editorial control, final approval type of things did he have over what the rest of the, what the audience is going to end up watching?
I don't know if control is the right word, because there's no final cut. ESPN had final cut, you know, they're the network. So, ultimately, the buck kind of stops with them in many ways. Major League Baseball is also a part of this, and the Yankees had to watch this, you know. So I think that it was kind of like a multifaceted kind of final cut, if you will. But yeah, I mean, Derek watched the cuts. Derek watched it to help us make sure that we were accurate, that we weren't like missing details or misrepresenting details. I think that that's very important. You know, he obviously had those experiences. So I think part of it was making sure that like we had everything in order. But again, honestly, it was collaboration. I mean, there weren't many moments where it felt like, you know, it was like this heavy handed experience to like get something across. I mean, that really didn't happen. I think that, you know, there were notes like I would get from the network, you know what I mean? So it's like, there wasn't anything that was out of the ordinary that I wouldn't expect if you were just dealing with any network giving you notes or an executive giving you notes. So it was all part of the process. There was nothing different or heavy handed about it. I think we were all trying to tell the best story we could possibly tell. And Derek was a part of that, but there wasn't a situation where we were mandated to do something or like, told that we had to do X, Y, and Z or say X, Y, and Z. They were just like any other notes, to be quite honest.
I think there was one part, and I forget the exact story. I've seen a few of the episodes through the screeners that they're kind enough to send out. He tells one story and says, like, this probably isn't going to make it. And it's obviously in it. Like, and he says it kind of like it's almost like he, and I forget what story it was, but it was kind of like he's embarrassed to actually talk about it and hope yeah. Nobody else sees this. But clearly that's in there. Was there anything that he told you that I don't want to talk about? Because there are a couple of things in there that he finally does address. And I'll get into one of them. But is there anything he said, you know, listen, I don't want to talk about that? And you were left to some other parts of other people to maybe tell that story or leave it out altogether?
Worried about letting someone else pick out the perfect avocado for your perfect impress them on the third date guacamole? Well, good thing Instacart shoppers are as picky as you are. They find ripe avocados like it's their guac on the line. They are milk expiration date detectives. They bag eggs like the 12 precious pieces of cargo they are. So let Instacart shoppers overthink your groceries so that you can overthink what you'll wear on that third date. Download the Instacart app to get free delivery on your first three orders while supplies last. Minimum $10 per order. Additional terms apply.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you love true crime or comedy, celebrity interviews or news, you call the shots on what's in your podcast queue. And guess what? Now you can call them on your auto insurance too with the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. It works just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance and they'll show you coverage options that fit your budget. Get your quote today at Progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.
Okay, picture this. It's Friday afternoon when a thought hits you. I can waste another weekend doing the same old whatever, or I can conquer it. I can hop into my all-new Hyundai Santa Fe and hit the road. Any road. The steeper, the better. Because my all-new Santa Fe is available with H-Track all-wheel drive, so I can hit the trail without a worry in the world. Heck, with three rows and best-in-class rear cargo space, I can pack the whole family in with all our gear. We've got available dual wireless charging for our phones, so we'll never lose touch with civilization, and we won't lose touch with the primordial power of Mother Earth. So which is it? Waste the weekend or do something a little more epic and conquer it in the all-new Hyundai Santa Fe. Visit HyundaiUSA.com or call 562-314-4603 for more details. Hyundai, there's joy in every journey.
I guess the only thing would really be like the super intricate details of his bachelor life. That, you know, but even then, again, he didn't say we can't talk about it. It was more like I have three daughters. You know what I mean? And I'm married. You know what I mean? It was in a context that makes total sense. So I think he's at a different stage in his life where certain things just don't have importance or like honest, like relevance to where he is at, in this stage of his life. So, I would say like the intricate details of his bachelor life might be the one thing, but it wasn't a mandate. Like we didn't sit down and he said, don't talk about this. We can't talk about that. Yeah. It just kind of naturally came along and made sense. And quite honestly, like some of those things as a storyteller don't really go anywhere. I mean, there's no controversy attached to it. There's no conflict. There's no, we make mention of him enjoying being a star. Yeah. You know, I mean, like we get into that for sure. But like the nitty gritty, like rumor stuff or like, you know, kind of like sensational stuff, we stay away from.
So there's two elements to this that I'd like to talk to you about. You know, first of all, I think he's probably the first superstar who played every single game on television, you know, because when his career starts in the mid 90s, there are still teams that don't have all 162 on TV. We're at a place now where that is true. Every game is on TV, but I think he was the first superstar who played every single game on like Mickey Mantle. There are games that, you know, weren't on TV. Joe DiMaggio, they weren't on TV. So he's one of those guys. And I would say like along those lines, Mike Trout is probably the first superstar in this sport who played every game in the social media age where people are dissecting every single night. But I don't know that he recognized that that was true of him, but he's probably aware of it. Does that make sense to you?
Oh yeah, absolutely. He might not articulate it because he might not, as you said, be aware that that was what was going on. To him, it was just like, I'm playing baseball. There are cameras here. There's media. That this just comes with the job. But I will say one of the most fascinating things about making this film was the evolution of the formats in which the coverage was captured.
Yeah.
So like we have SD, we have film, 16 millimeter film. There's the, you know, HD starting to come along. Then it's like full blown HD. So like he played for so long that the actual formats that captured his career changed multiple times, you know, and it was fascinating to see that, you know, like in episodes 3 and 4, I believe we have way more like 16 millimeter footage than we did prior to those episodes and after those episodes. And on a technical level, you know, it presents a challenge because you're presenting the film in one format, but like while you're making it, it's just incredible to see just how many ways this was, his career was captured over the years.
The other element of that, and you kind of mentioned it with what is family life now. You know, he's married with three daughters. His kids never saw him play. Okay, he had that part of his life after his career. So, do you think he eventually wants them to? I mean, obviously they're too young for this now. But do you think part of making this and the way that it was made, he would like them to watch it at whatever appropriate age, so that they know like who he was publicly because he is somebody else to the rest of the world?
That is the number one reason why he decided to make this. Yeah. I think people will learn from this film how much he loves being a dad and how important family really is to him and how crucial Hannah and his daughters are to his life now. So I know the main reason he wanted to do this was so his life and career were chronicled, so that they could see it later. He's not totally convinced they're ever going to watch this at any age or believe him, but that was the main reason and motivating factor for him wanting to do this. And I think that also contributes to him being open. I think he wants his daughters to know who he is, what made him, who his family is, who their families are. So, yeah, it's a major contributing factor.
Okay, so beyond that, he was always a less is more kind of guy when it comes to the access and the and what he was willing to provide to people. But now, you know, now he's on social media. Now he's being that dad who's, you know, his wife is phoning him in the car, interacting with his kids, and they're posting that kind of stuff. Now, I understand there's a lot of promotional aspect to now him being on social media, but I mean, are you surprised that we got here? How did we get here?
I don't know how we got here, to be quite honest. I am surprised, because when I first met Derek and talked to Derek, he said, yeah, I'm never doing this social media thing. Like, it's just not happening. And then, you know, a year or two later, he's on social media, and I think he genuinely enjoys it. Like, yeah. You know, I think he sees the positive sides of it. You know, I think he sees that, you know, people are genuinely excited to learn more about him and like hear his daughter in the back of the car talking about poopy monsters and all that stuff. So, yeah, I mean, I'm sure that like the promotional aspect is one reason, but I don't think that that's like the driving force behind it. I think he understanding that, you know, I made this film, I'm going to be out there anyway. Like, what's the way to like continue that? And I think, again, he's in a different stage of his life. You know, he's not under the microscope anymore, being Derek Jeter, face of the New York Yankees. And I think that he's probably a little bit more relaxed, you know, and I think he's comfortable sharing a little bit more about himself, his day to day. And I genuinely think he's having fun with social media. And I think it's a great thing. I think people always wanted to be closer to Derek. And I think in a very sincere way, I think there are a lot of people that just wanted to know more about him because they revered him, they liked him, they're inspired by him. So I think it was a great move. I'm happy that he did it, and I'm happy that people were excited and engaging with him.
I actually do remember having conversations with him like early in the days of Twitter, and like him wondering why anybody on earth would want to just put stuff, because he only saw the bad side of it. He only saw the downward spiral that could happen when you say something wrong, you know, in that format, and what could happen. The A-Rod relationship is a very big part of this. And I think you'd actually do a great job of leading us up to that, because we all know it's coming, and you kind of tease it along the way until you get to the big crux of it, when he gets traded and all, whether you're the Esquire article, when he gets traded over and all, everything that happened after that. You know, it's, and I thought they were both really honest with you. It was really cool to see, especially because they both tried to downplay that aspect of it to us while it was happening. And they didn't say we were lying, but they did kind of tell us that we were making too much out of it. And it's pretty clear now that we weren't making too much out of it. There was a lot of stuff there. Everything that we kind of said was going on really was true. They were just doing their best to protect themselves and their team and their families, I guess, from everything that was happening. So I did get the sense that Alex, you know, has some regrets, even though he's still kind of, you know, he owns up to it. I don't think he, you know, thinks he made full blown mistakes, but I think he feels like he does have some regrets. Derek doesn't really seem to fully want to admit regrets easily in any part of it. Do you think any part of what happened there that he does genuinely regret and thinks that he made any sort of mistakes along the way?
I think a lot of things come down to trust with Derek, mm-hmm. not just with Alex, but just in life.
Yeah.
And I think that trusting people, whether they were teammates or not, is a big part of the equation for him. And I think that he looks at things not through regret or not regret, but can I trust this person? Mm-hmm. And I think when he decides that he can't trust you, it is very hard for him to get away from that. I mean, I think in the film, he says he looks at it almost as a character flaw. So he's self-aware that that's what's going on.
Yeah.
But he also has reason. And I'm not saying it's directed towards Alex. I think, you know, his upbringing, being biracial, and people like questioning like who he is, who his family is, I think that has a profound impact on him. So I think for Derek, it's not necessarily a regret. I think looking back, he would probably say, and he does say this actually in a film, that, you know, he could have trusted teammates more, and mm-hmm. that it could have been his responsibility to be more entrusting of a larger circle of teammates. So I think that's the closest thing you would get to Derek saying that there may be a regret there. But I don't think Derek views his life in a prism of regret or no regret. I think it's trust, loyalty, and operating off of those values. So I think maybe there was a point that he looks back and he says, I should have trusted Alex more as a teammate or embraced him more. I'm not totally sure. I'm not convinced that that's how Derek looks at it with Alex specifically. Sure. I think for Derek, Alex won MVPs. He played well for the Yankees. So it was like, well, if he did a great job, what was I going to do to change it? Yeah. You know, Derek looks at it very specific in terms of how Alex contributed to winning. So I guess that's a roundabout way of saying I don't think Derek actually has regrets. I think he just looks at things in the prism of, can I trust this person? Yes or no. And that's how I'm going to move forward.
I think there's an interesting part of this relationship too, that I don't know if you touched on this and built it into this on purpose, or if I just see it because I've always thought it was an underplayed element and I kind of paid attention to this detail. They have two drastically different upbringings. And I think we don't, when we talk about the mistakes Alex makes and, you know, the quote unquote perfect way Derek handled things for so many years with his being in the public eye, I think we underplay that. He has two college educated parents, and Alex had a single mom who works, you know, two or three jobs. You know, that's drastically different experience that shapes who they are. And I kind of felt like we underplayed that over the years. I thought you touched on it. Was that intentional, or was that kind of just how the story played out?
No, it was both, because yeah. I didn't go into it knowing exactly what Alex was going to reveal.
Okay.
I didn't really know how far he was going to take it until he actually sat in the chair and started answering questions. So it wasn't intentional going into it, but once he revealed that stuff, I thought it was an interesting dynamic that also fell into themes of the entire film about family, emotional maturity on Derek's part. I mean, I just think that Derek was rare in the sense that he was way more mature than his age.
Yeah.
And I think that that showed itself in so many different ways. And I don't necessarily look at it as a fault of Alex, but if you're a superstar 2021, most people won't handle it the way that Derek did. I think that that's incredibly rare. So, yeah, I mean, I think it was a clash of maturity at that age, understanding, perception, a global perspective that I think Derek has that is also rare for someone so young. I don't think Alex had that. I think it's fair to say that. So, yeah, I mean, I think there are a lot of elements to it. I'm happy we were able to add that layer to the conversation. So it's not just this, well, they didn't like each other. You know, there's way more to it. There was way more nuance. And I think that we captured that pretty well.
You've gotten to show this to a few different audiences already. So, I mean, you've had a chance to not just make it, but you've seen it. You've watched other people react to it. What's some of the experience that you took away from that of watching, you know, Derek, his family, some other people, the audience at Yankee Stadium, all those kinds of things.
That the story's landing. I mean, you just always hope that when you make a film that people get it, you know, that they get the nuance, they get the storytelling, they get like the hints about Alex, and then that build. You just hope that you do a good enough job where people are along for the ride and they understand what you're trying to tell. And in every instance so far, people just get it. And like, that's the biggest compliment a filmmaker can have. So yeah, it's been great.
What did Derek say to you when it was, you know, like when he watched everything, when you guys kind of put the wraps on it, what did he tell you?
I mean, I think in very Derek fashion, he said, you know, I just hope people love it. You know, it wasn't even about like how he felt about it. He really likes the film. He's proud of it, all of those things. But the first thing is, I just hope people love it, you know? So he's always thinking about others, thinking about the fans, thinking about the audience. So it was a very Derek response, and I guess I wouldn't expect anything else.
All right. So what's next for you? What's on deck for your projects?
I don't know. I'm talking to a couple people. There's some interesting projects out there. You know, I tried to play the long game and take a bet on myself like Aaron Judge and not fully commit to something until this comes out. So I'm close to doing that. I'm in talks for a couple of projects, so we'll see, but it'll be good regardless. It'll be something that people can sink their teeth into.
All right. I can't let you go without, you know, your very active presence on Twitter during every Yankees game, right? Yep. You're a Yankees fan, and you're enjoying this year. I know. and you've actually taken a very, you know, I try to take a level-headed approach with my coverage and what I'm watching. And in this particular season, I feel like you've done a lot of that because, you know, the team is really good. And even when they lose, like they did the last couple of days, you're not bouncing off the walls. You see what's happening. Give me your halfway point and, assessment of what you see from the Yankees and what you're looking forward to as we head into fall.
I think they're obviously a true title contender. I think that they have all the ingredients to make it work. I also think that it's clear that they have some holes that they need to address. And I think that they need a little bit more depth in the outfield, definitely in the rotation. I feel like this is the one year where I feel like I'm pretty convinced that they can win the title. I mean, I feel very strongly about it, but I think they have to go for it. And I think Cashman will. I think that there's some spots where they can shore it up a little bit. And I think this trade deadline is going to tell a lot about where they can go and what their true potential is. I also think right now and you can tell me maybe better than anybody, they just look tired. You know,
sure. Yeah, like, there's a little bit of that. Yeah. Listen, you're going to go through. And honestly, I just did this math last night after the game, Thursday night after the game. In their last 24, they're 13-11, which isn't you'd think they were like, 5-19 the way people talk about them. But I mean, they've actually gained ground in the division by going 13-11 because everybody else has kind of played with them. They've lost a little bit of ground to Houston. And that's, where you're talking about the home field, that's where that's important. But listen, it's not supposed to be easy, right? They make it look easy sometimes. And listen, you talk to all these guys who played on 98 and, and with Derek and everything like that. And I think, I don't know, you tell me, did your appreciation for how a team goes through a season like this, did that change based off of all the people you talked to who made the winning look easy even when it wasn't?
Yeah, and that's actually a major reason why, one, I feel very strongly they can win this year, and two, that they have just the kind of right makeup. There are a lot of guys from that 98 team that said that one reason they were so successful is because they were committed to winning every game, every night. Yeah. And they wanted to impose their will on the opposition. And I feel like this team is finally doing that. I think that, even when they lose, they're close games. Like, they're not just like – they're competing until the end. They believe that they can come back. Even last night, Thursday night against the Reds, they were one run away from tying the game again. So that was very similar to 98. And one thing that Derek has told me repeatedly, both for the 98 team and for this year's team, is how you deal with adversity. And that's how you know that you have like what it takes to be a champion. Can you weather the adversity and how are you going to respond to it? And I think even with the adversity, quote unquote, that the Yankees have dealt with so far this year, I mean, they still handle it incredibly well. So I feel very confident, but I also want to be mindful that, there's some work to be done.
My thanks again to Randy Wilkins. The first episode of The Captain airs on ESPN this Monday, 10 p.m. after the Home Run Derby. Future episodes air every Thursday through August 11th. Check your listings for replays, also streaming on ESPN+. Hey, if you're new here, please check out the 30 with Murdy archive at Odyssey, Apple, wherever you get your podcasts. Go back and check out recent episodes with Howard Bryant, author of the new Ricky Henderson biography, or Paul O'Neill about his new book that he wrote with Jack Curry. Also, check out the WFA and Baseball Insiders podcast for more baseball and Yankees-related talk. Make sure to subscribe and review and all that jazz. And until next time, I'm Sweeney Murdy. Thanks for listening.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you love true crime or comedy, celebrity interviews or news, you call the shots on what's in your podcast queue. And guess what? Now you can call them on your auto insurance too with the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. It works just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance, and they'll show you coverage options that fit your budget. Get your quote today at Progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.
You could spend the weekend doing the same old whatever, or you could conquer the weekend in the all-new Hyundai Santa Fe. Visit HyundaiUSA.com for more details. Hyundai, there's joy in every journey.
We really need new phones.
T-Mobile will cover the cost of four amazing new iPhone 15s, and each line is only $25 a month.
New iPhone 15s? It's better
over here. Only at T-Mobile, get four iPhone 15s on us and four lines for $25 per line per month with eligible trade-in when you switch.
Minimum of four lines for $25 per line per month with auto pay discount using debit or bank account. $5 more per line without auto pay, plus taxes and fees. Phone fee at 24 monthly bill credits for well qualified customers. Contact us before canceling account to continue bill credits or credit stop and balance on required finance agreement due. $35 per line connection charge applies. See T-Mobile.com.